Picture? Seriously, I want to take your picture. It's easier for attendance counting as I just count the heads. Do it again. You know, these cameras are wonderful. My wife and I were recently out in Salt Lake City in Utah. This camera was amazing, the quality of the picture. I have a big DSLR picture camera with all these interchangeable lenses. This is better. My name, somebody asked me where I got my name from, the last name from. I tell them my dad. And it's actually, Gus is not my name. It's actually just a nickname because my whole name is Augustinus Corinus Johannes Olstorn. It was so long my mother didn't even use it. She just called me Gus. And it is a Dutch name, right? So I originally came from Ontario and moved to Quebec in about 40 years ago. Met my wife. We have four wonderful children and even more wonderfuler grandchildren. They're so great that I think I should have gone straight to grandkids, bypass all the hassle, and just have grandchildren. Actually, when we came from vacation for our 5 weeks away, my grandson, 9 years old, gave me a hug. Lasted about a minute. That's worth gold. That's worth gold. So, I worked for 39 years in, anybody heard of Bombardier? Yeah, I have shares in the company. So, hasn't turned out well, and as of tomorrow, I'll be semi-retired. I work 3 days a week, and so this is great. I actually work right now for CAE. They make simulators for aviation simulators, and actually I'm the lead technical training developer on the Global 7500, which is Bombardier's flagship business aircraft, only $73 million each. And so it's the most advanced business jet, probably one of the most advanced aircraft in the world. And so we developed the technical training for that. It's a complicated aircraft, but not as complicated as the amazing evidences for a young universe. So there are many evidences that suggest that the universe is far less old than what we have been told to believe, billions of years, etc. And we only have a limited time, I think only have a couple hours, and we should be able to cover just a few of them. And there seriously are a lot of evidences, and we're going to touch on a few of them, which I think are relevant to most people. Most people can catch on pretty quickly. You know, in the world today, we have actually two, at least certain in Western civilization, two models of origins. Either the biblical account, if you take the Bible as it is written without trying to read into it, it would suggest that the universe was created by God out of nothing about 6,000 years ago. We get this largely from the genealogies of Adam, starting with Adam, and we get that in Genesis and 1 Chronicles and the Gospel of Luke. So we get the genealogies based on those, and about 1,600 years after the initial creation, there was a world-shaping event called the Global Flood, or the Flood of Noah. So, for example, the Garden of Eden would have been totally demolished in that Global Flood because it really rearranged everything on the earth. And the life before the flood would have been significantly different, allowing people and animals to live exceedingly long times. And but after the flood, things changed quite a bit environmentally and climate-wise. And so, of course, the lifespan has been decreased now to something like 70, 80, maybe 100 years. On the other hand, we're told, as a fact, that 13.8 billion years ago, first there was nothing, literally nothing. And then there was something. How do you go from nothing to something? It's a question of faith. You just have to take it as on faith that there was nothing, then became something. And that this was an enormous, the singularity, which was almost infinitesimally small, blew up and became the entire universe and created all this wonderful order and what we see today in humans and plants and all over the universe, this fine tuning of the universe just by accident. So that is the two models that we have to. Now, if you can't, the time frame, you can't have any farther apart. 6,000, 13.8 billion. I mean, it's like little to very big. And 6,000 years is still a long time anyway. And so wherever you go, you're told that evolution is true. It's a fact. Only people whose intellectual capacity is somewhat diminished would believe otherwise. And you know, you're told in universities and high school that evolution has been proven, it has been shown and demonstrated, it's a fact, and, you know, dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago, on and on and on, and the creation account as given short thrift. In fact, it's not even included. I live in Quebec. It's a very secular. What secular really means is excluding God. You remove God from the picture. He cannot be involved in the equation. So if he's not involved in the equation, that automatically defaults to the secularist, to the evolutionary side. It's not really fair, but that's the way the world goes. So one of the best, it is a problem in the Christian community, the Christian world, because we were told, and the Bible tells us, and Christ holds to that, that the universe was created out of nothing a short period of time, relatively short period of time ago. And so people who are faced with what they believe is scientific evidence that that's not correct have a challenge to their faith. And Christians, of course, have felt that for several hundred years. But it's not only Christians, also other denominations. And one of the worst ways of dealing with that is to not deal with it. There's an article put out in the National Post about how a Baptist girl became Muslim. And it was, and this is the story, it was quite, I found it quite interesting because I also study Islam. Okay, I actually read the Quran this year and talked to Muslims, etc. And, they have a theistic worldview. So it's also a problem, evolution is also a problem for Muslims because many Muslims fall away because of the evolutionary worldview. But in this particular case, the report in National Post was that there was this girl who grew up in the East and she said, according to the she found evidence of round earth, fetal development, and even evolution in the Islamic holy book. I didn't see it. But anyway, she says she grew up Baptist, and then she went to Hamilton, Ontario, met a Muslim guy, and then she got married, and she converted to Islam. And she still remembers how her questions about dinosaurs and evolution were dismissed and rejected by Bible scholars at summer camp. This caused Joy to embrace agnosticism and then reject the faith of her parents, which then, of course, brought her to university. She met this Muslim guy who had some explanation and became a Muslim. But it's precisely because this question was not addressed that it became a problem for her. She rejected Christianity because it wasn't addressed. And so I'm glad to see today in this church that at least they're addressing this problem or this issue rather than having it to try and, take people back into Christianity who are long dismissive of it. And so this is what we encourage young people and parents to prepare their children because these questions are going to be faced head on. There's many other social issues that we have to face. This is a major one. I work part-time for Creation Ministries International. I do these tours. I'm doing one now in PEI. Actually, I didn't make it on Friday night because the flight was delayed, so nobody showed up because I didn't. Right? So I felt bad about that, nothing I could do. But we have PhD scientists. We have more PhD scientists on staff than any other Christian ministry. And these are from regular universities, degrees in astrophysics and genetics, etc. They're the ones who write the books and the DVD material, etc., that we have showcasing here and you can buy online, etc. Our website is creation.com. And I'm going to ask the ushers if you want to pass around the clipboards for signing up for our information, our what we call e-byte, our info-bytes. And all you need to do is put your name and email address on. Please write in English and not Arabic. Okay. Sometimes emails look like they're written in Arabic. That was supposed to be funny. Usually you have to explain it's going to be funny. That's not working. Okay. All right. After this, we'll have a time for question and answers. And so if you we're back, I think. Just disconnected here. Voila. So when it comes to design in nature, such as this hummingbird, it is an incredible, and having been in aviation for a long time, I can tell you that this is an incredible flying machine. It is, anybody who wants to design something like this, a drone or a helicopter, is looking at the hummingbird and saying, wow, this is incredible. In fact, there is a branch of science that actually tries to mimic what's found in nature. It's called biomimetics. And this is to look at the incredible design in this thing and how you can pack all of this stuff up and make it work and fly like it does. It's incredible engineering. I work for a company, CAE, and they not only do aviation, but they do medical training. And they have now into augmented reality and virtual reality, they will have a fake cadaver in which through these goggles you can actually see internal organs, bones and stuff like that. And so it's for training medical professionals. And for example, they can actually lift the heart out, a beating heart, virtually of course, and you can see how it works and you turn around. It's really cool stuff, right? But when you look at it, you realize the human body has been designed amazingly. Pack everything. How did they get all packed in there? The liver, the kidneys, the pancreas, everything has to work functioning perfectly well. And it's this argument design that actually wins many people over to a theistic point of view, talking about an intelligent designer. For example, a well-known atheist, Anthony Flew, actually did become a left the evolutionary camp because he recognized the design in nature could not come about by accident, which is what's required for the evolutionary point of view. It's just too complex. It's just trying to say, oh, I found this cell phone out in the field. Nobody made it. It just happens to be there over time. Would anybody actually believe this? No, of course not. So when you look at the design in nature, you say, that speaks to an intelligent designer. But we also have the issue of time. Now, it might be argued that if the Bible never had any time frame, then we could go along with the idea that maybe God used evolution. But then the Bible does give us a time frame about 6,000 years ago and the global flood, so we're kind of constrained with those things. So when you look at, for example, the Big Bang Theory, the idea is that nature explains it all. There is no need for God. We can go from a Big Bang to man all by... It isn't about science as much as it is about a worldview called naturalism. We can explain everything in the universe without reference to God. And that's why the whole idea of natural selection and Darwinism caught on very quickly, not because the scientific evidence compelled it to, but it allowed mankind to remove God from the paradigm of origin and existence, put him on the shelf and say, we don't need you anymore, we're smart enough to figure it out ourselves, and we have evolution, and we have the Big Bang, ta-da, we've got it all figured out. And there are many people hang their hats on the Big Bang Theory. It's interesting, any theory that's falling apart, it is the Big Bang Theory, simply because it doesn't work. Recently, they came out with, several months or so ago, that they've just shaved off 2 billion years off the 13.8 billion years. Why? Because of the calculation. It's based on some cosmological constant, depends on which you adopt. You'll have either 30.8, you'll have more or less. And they're saying, the article is talking about that more or less billions of years. And yet we were told this is an absolute fact. A while ago there was about inflation. This guy was going to get a Nobel Prize for inflation in the universe. And they quickly withdrawn because they knew it couldn't work. And there's a lot of things with the Big Bang. That's why people are moving away from the Big Bang. And some scientists say there never was a Big Bang in the first place. The universe was steady state. Okay. All right, now we're down to Earth. We have, of course, the strata and the rocks. And we're told that the strata is the geological column showing us from the Cambrian, Precambrian time all the way up. And it's a record, they say, of the evolution of life from the bottom, which is the oldest, several billion years ago, and then it's now coming up to the top, and it's very, very clear, they say, the simplest, oldest are at the bottom, the most modern, and are at the top. Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. And the idea would be that you had dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago, and then you allowed rise to the mammals. What they don't tell you is that they find mammals with dinosaurs. You don't see this in a museum, but that's what you put. It's all mixed up together. It isn't as clean cut as that. And it does create a problem for it. On the other hand, you have the biblical account, 6,000 years ago, 6 days. We're not going to get into that. That's another talk. But just reading from the Genesis account, it appears to be 6 days. Now, there are people who say, come on, six, like 6 days, like in 24-hour days? I can understand why people don't like that. and want it to be something else. But from our plain reading of scriptures, and that's the way we believe Jesus and the apostles took it, is that it was six normal days. The whole idea of millions and billions of years is a modern notion. It only came up during the Enlightenment. In fact, in the universities in the West, the biblical account of history was the history of the world, according to the Bible. And universities, my son went to Cambridge to get a PhD in math, and Cambridge was started in 1209 to the training of priests, because the universities were for the training for Christian worldviews, for training of the Christian ministers. When the Enlightenment came along, that sort of drifted off, and now universities are, we're not really sure what they do anymore, but they you spend a lot of money and you get a certificate, and then hopefully you can find a job when you're done, right? Now, all four of my sons went to university, and that's great for them. So of course, you have the biblical. Genesis starts off with 6,000 years ago, and then there was a global flood. These are two major elements in the creation account. These both go, and they explain a lot. Now, I have to admit, there's a lot of unanswered questions. We can't answer them today. I don't have all the answers. But this has created a number of questions for people. Even if you, as an average person, average Christian, are having questions about that, you're not alone. There are many, many people who have that, even those who are giving leadership to the church. For example, Gleason Archer was a well-known, I'm not sure if he's alive or not, well-known biblical commentator. And so he was considered an authority. If you go to Bible college, this is one of the guys you're going to read a commentary. But this is what he wrote about the Genesis account. He says, from a superficial reading of Genesis 1, the impression would seem to be that the entire creative process took place in six 24-hour days. If this was the true intent of the Hebrew author, this seems to run counter to modern scientific research, which indicates that the planet Earth was created several billion years ago. So here's a well-respected, high-level Christian theologian. What is he expressing? He's expressing some doubt about. Notice he says, from a superficial reading, if this was the true intent, would seem to run counter. Rather ambiguous terminology, don't you think, for someone who should be emphatic about the biblical account. Why was he ambiguous? Well, because he doesn't know what to do with the science of this. He didn't know what to do with it. He thinks that this is a fact. And because so many people say it and so many people are advocating it, I mean, all of these smart people believe that, and I'm just a theologian. What do I know about science? So that's the tension. And a lot of people, a lot of Christians have this tension. Like, how do I deal with the science of it versus the religion of it? That's a good question. It's a very valid question. But one of the other questions, even a question before that, is what difference does it make? What difference does it make? If you believe the Earth is 6,000 years old, yours is 13.8 billion years, what difference does it make? Because unless it makes some significant difference, this is just an academic exercise, and what do you think? What do you think? Well, great, we all think differently. Wonderful. It makes a big difference. This is the important part. What makes a difference? What makes it, you know, what does it matter if God created things in 6 days, 6,000 years ago, or he used the process of evolution? And certainly Christian apologists do use that. Biologos, Hugh Ross and others they believe the Big Bang is true and that God used the process of evolution. So what is the truth? What difference does it make? I will tell you, it makes a difference in this, in death. Because the real question is, why do we die? I'm actually undergoing not me personally, but a friend of mine has Lou Gehrig's disease. He has, well, I understand he's got years to live. It's very slow, progressive disease, degeneration. He told me recently that he has organized to have a procedure done which will end his life in the next couple of weeks. Quebec, it's allowed. He wants to be killed. Wow, that's kind of a heavy one, right? Somebody you know, co-work with and friends with, and he wants to be dead. What does he think? He thinks that his suffering, and there is suffering in ALS, and you know, it's not an easy thing to go through. We can't talk. All he can do, he can hardly walk. He thinks that after he dies, it's going to be peace. It's going to be bliss. I will have no more suffering. Well, is that true? Is that true? I mean, atheism offers that. Atheism actually offers nothing. What does atheism offer? Offer nothing. It says that after you die, there is nothing. And then there's no hope. And in fact, there's no real reason why we're here anyway. It's all a big accident, and meaning and morality just are shot out of the window. Doesn't mean that atheists are necessarily immoral people, but if there's no purpose for us being here, what's the point? And many people want to commit suicide because they think there's just no point, and at the end, it's all over. But the Bible tells us a different story. The Bible tells us that God had created everything from nothing, ex nihilo, and everything was perfect. It was great. Adam and Eve lived in the garden. It was perfect. And God said it was very good. So it was made very good. But we know the story of Adam and Eve, that they didn't believe that God was telling them the truth, and then things became very bad. They rebelled against God deliberately. Adam was the only one actually had pure free will. He couldn't blame his mother or father. He couldn't blame his educational system. It was just him. And he said, God, I don't believe you. I don't trust you. I think you're holding out on me. I'm going to do what I think I should do, and I'm going to disobey. He's going to rebel. And God says, Adam, if you do that, you're going to die. You're going to begin the process of dying. Well, we know that that was true. Okay. So first it was very good, and then it became bad. Well, if it was good and then became bad, what do I do with what we believe are the millions and billions of years of fossils that are in the fossil record? Where do I place them in relation to the biblical account? If Adam and Eve were about 6,000 years ago, and somebody tells you that these things happened millions of years ago, these dinosaurs died out, then we have a theological problem. Either there was no Adam and Eve, or this whole story of the Bible is convoluted and corrupted. And so many people who are convinced that the explanation is true are just, many in this, chuck the Bible, says forget it, I'm not going to follow a fairy tale. And if the evolutionary account is true, then I would say they had a reason to do that. And of course, that's why we're here today. So do we place it ahead of it was bad and then it became good? Well, it doesn't make any sense. Or maybe all that bad happened after Adam and Eve were created. So all this, first it was good, then it was bad, and then, you know, Adam brought sin into the world that brought death and bad things, and the fossil record is a record of all those bad things that happened, dying, disease, and suffering. So it all depends on where you want to place this. But that would mean, of course, that this wasn't millions of years ago, billions of years ago. It was within the biblical time frame of 6,000 years. And that is the challenge before us today. And we want to look at some of those things. And so is the fossil record a record of death and disease and suffering? Yes. Dinosaurs have been found with tumors. They've been found eating one another. Dinosaur bones have been found with holes in it made by other dinosaurs eating them. And of course, they're dead. So obviously it's recorded death. But was it billions and millions of years ago? That is the question we want to look at. Yeah, it's true that all this misery took over place. It took place, but not over billions of years ago. Okay. But theistic evolutionists who try to say that God used evolution have to end up saying that it was God who's responsible for all the death and disease and suffering that went on for that entire period. If they claim that God set it up like that, why would God set it up like that? So a lot of suffering and misery and death over millions and billions of years. What kind of a good God is that? If people have trouble with, you know, claiming God is good because he allows ALS, if they have a problem with that, then the theistic evolution says, that's nothing. Wait, how bad you see God was for the billions of years. Wow, but that's not the God of the Bible. That's the God of the evolutionist and the theistic evolutionist. So the fossil record records bad things that happened after the creation of mankind. Now, People say, well, you creationists, you have your own facts, and the evolutionists have their own facts. This is not the case. We all deal with the same fact. We all deal with the same things. Like, here's a trilobite. Here's an insect in amber. Here's some sand from Antelope X Canyon near the Grand Canyon. And things like that. There's lots of other fossils. We all have the same thing. The question is now, how do I interpret? How did this thing become fossilized? How long does it take to fossilize? When was it fossilized? Those are the questions. The fact that this is a trilobite is not. This is not up for, we all agree on that. It's the story behind it is what we got to look at. And so the theist and the anti-theist will have different arguments. Now, in the case of Darwin and those people in the evolutionary camp, they deal only with natural processes. Supernatural processes are dismissed out of hand. They're not included. In fact, Charles Darwin, guess what he studied at Cambridge? He studied theology. Ironically, we think of him as a scientist, but he's not. He was an observer of science, not really a scientist. He didn't do any experiments, right? So he was a theologian. He studied theology, but he did say, I cannot believe the God that he would have studied at Cambridge would use the process that I am advocating. In other words, he's advocating a theory, and he knows that what he's learned about God, that God would not have used this theory. And yet, theistic evolution, they're saying he did. I think we're getting things a little backwards here. On the other hand, when you have those who believe that God had created, yes, you do have natural processes, but you also have catastrophic processes, where the evolution would use uniformitarian process. What this is basically saying is that the processes we see today, in other words, the continents, we see how the continents fit together. Yes, we agree with that, the continents fit together. And they say, well, they're moving in relation to each other very, very slowly, like centimeters for 100 years. Yes, they are moving very slowly, centimeters for 100 years. This we can observe. And then they'll say, well, it's always been like that. And how do you know this? So this is an assumption that starts off with, well, it's always been like that. And how do you know? Nobody could prove that. It's just an assumption you have to take. It's taken axiomatically, and you just have to accept it. And so we're going to look at some evidences that suggest that those assumptions are invalid. At least they're untestable in the scientific realm. Of course, also in the creation account, we have supernatural processes. God had created according to his words from nothing. So when we look at the Adam, what was he made from? He was made from the dust of the earth. He was not born of a woman. He was created from the dust of the earth. Now explain, how does that possible? Right? How is it? Come on. Nobody knows how that's done. Absolutely. That's because it's supernatural. It's beyond the natural. And a lot of people are looking for natural explanations for supernatural processes. This is nonsensical. You're not going to find it because, you know, God explained how you did all this stuff. And God said, I'm not going to explain how you did it because I didn't use natural process. I just spoke and it was. Now, this has to be taken by faith, of course. But also the idea that from nothing came something, that's also something that comes by faith. So if we're going to talk, faith and faith is one thing. We're going to talk science and science, that's something else. But it's not a case of science versus religion. It's a faith, it's a fact, it's a discussion regarding evidences. You know, how do you explain it and how do you explain it? And let's see which makes the most sense based on what we know about how the universe works. So for example, we have here the natural Grand Canyon. I've been to there 40 years ago. We were there this year. We actually drove through Salt Lake and down to Grand Canyon, 11,000 kilometers. And it is indeed a Grand Canyon. Anybody ever been there? Great. It is awesome. Awesome. Now you can see all the strata. And they say the strata, if you go to the Interpretation Center, took 2 billion years to accumulate. And at the bottom, they'll say, is the simplest creatures. And at the top is the uppermost, the more modern creature. That's what they say. It doesn't quite work like that. How big? What about the Grand Canyon? Well, it's about 466 kilometers long, and it's almost 6,000 feet. I'm imperial measured. I don't get really metricized yet. So if I say 6,000 feet, you just convert. But anyway, so 6,000 over a mile deep for the old timers, okay? That's very deep. Now, when they look at Colorado River, how do they explain the canyon? They say, well, the Colorado River, being a river of such size, well, it would take a little bit of sand all the time and then move it down river off into, the Gulf of Mexico, Pacific Ocean. And, of course, you look at the river and you think, that's a lot of dirt that's got to move. So, yes, it's going to take a very, very long time. But are you asking the right question? Was it actually the river that moved all the dirt? How would you know? Is anybody there? Again, you're starting off with assumptions. So we're going to look at some of those assumptions. So around the Grand Canyon, there are side canyons, and we happen to go to one called the Antelope X Canyon. This is on Navajo land, and you take tours in it. And they have all these compressed sandstone. And you'll notice that they're beautiful arches. When they have flash floods, the water comes through there and sculpts all these things out, and then the water's gone, and it's basically dry. And actually, here is some of the sand from that. Okay? That's Antelope X Canyon. Recall the Antelope X is because when they looked up, they saw what looked like an X, and that's how it became Antelope X. This is my wife and I. I'm on the right. And so when you look closely at it, you see these varves. These are very fine layers of sand. And I asked the Navajo guide, I said, well, how are they formed? She says, by wind. I said, I don't think so. And I said, I don't really think so. We sort of got in a little tussle here, but I don't think so. It seems to me this makes better sense in water. And I'll just jump over to something here, because in experiments done in the University, I think it was Minnesota. I'm just going to switch over here. Hang on. This guy here. Oh, it's popping up. There it is. So this is an experiment with water running and a lot of particles. And as the water moves, you see that whitish band there? It's zooming in closer. It's a natural phenomenon, hydrodynamic action. As the water moves, the particles separate, amazingly, into lines. Very well-defined lines. Now, the quality of the video is not that great. It's a little old. But as you can see here, this is very significant that this, so we have experimental evidence here, and you can see that the water's moving. Yeah. So this has been observed, this has been experimented. So the varves, these little, is a result of water action, which makes sense because it goes on a long stretch. To suppose that it comes by sand, by airborne sand, which would mean that places like Saudi Arabia, which has a lot of sand, would have these same things. But what you find over there is you find dunes. Right? You don't find all the stratification like you see here. Okay. So, switching back. And presenter view. Sorry about that. And as we like to say in Quebec, voila. All right. Again, it's me and my wife. Married 39 years. So, all right. So coming back to this canyon. So this is brought by water, and these are sedimentary rock. And sedimentary rocks are those which are sedimented out of water. That's why they call them sedimentary rocks. And so when you looked at the height of the column, or the amount of sediments, based on the supposed age and the depth, calculated roughly that a foot, or about 30 centimeters, would have taken about 300,000 years to form. 300,000 years to form that. And I don't think so. But straight math. I said, well, not because just I say so, but these were brought by water, and these barbs are straight and clean to go for miles and miles, extended over huge ranges. So this would mean that within the 300,000 years and more, there was no thunderstorms. There was no rainfall, which would have caused erosion. Right? So when you have a rainfall, you have thunderstorms, that cuts erosion through all this material. Exactly what formed the canyon in the first place. This, with all this flash flooding. And yet, though, looking at the layers, there's no evidence of any erosion. And so what we, and also there's no evidence of any plant, which means in 300,000 years, you never had any plants grow, had no roots, no trees, nothing. Anybody ever see this? Anybody had? So we look at that and say, well, it doesn't really make sense for the time period, but how could we see the same type of patterns in a very short period of time? Well, I suggest two examples of that. In Kansas City, Missouri, and we were there in this summer, and I perfectly went through what they call a downtown Steamboat Arabia. Steamboat is a river, steamboat that was on the Missouri River. It was sunk in 1856, and it was holed. It was a wooden hull. It sank there. They marked it. They knew exactly where it was because they didn't want other steamships getting sunk because of the wreck. But it was full of 200 tons of household goods, boots, shoes, gloves. And in the museum, they have this all on display. It's very fascinating. We went there. So somebody thought, well, why don't we dig it up and get all this stuff for a museum? Sounded great. Where do you think they went to look for it? It was a riverboat. Where do you think they would look for it? You would think it a river, but it wasn't near the river. It was about a half a mile or almost a kilometer away from the river. A riverboat wasn't in the river. That's right. It was because the Missouri and the Mississippi River are meandering rivers. They change shape over time. And actually, in 132 years, it changed a half a mile. And so they use Bob Hawley and his friends. They use a proton magnetometer. I have no clue what that is. But anyway, they found it, and it was on some farmer's field, and they said, we want to dig down there. We think there's a boat down there. He says, well, you got one season to get it out. After that, I'm closing it up, and I need my field back. And so they did. They worked night and day for that whole entire season, and they used lots of water pumps to pump out the water because the water table was very high. And they actually did get all this stuff, 200 tons of material. They put it in a museum. If you ever go to Kansas City, you got to see it. It's fantastic. But what I was interested in is what you saw on the sides of the opening. Right? What do you see? You see all this stratification, just like you saw on Antelope Canyon, just like you see in Grand Canyon. And this was all done in 132 years to a depth of 45 feet. Now, this isn't rock yet because it hasn't dried out. The water table is very high. And so, but the same pattern, which is explained by that demonstration, that's how you get that pattern. So we have observed it, did experiments to prove it, that this layering, and we can know the ship went down 132 years ago, you can get 45 feet in 132 years. Another example, This is Mount St. Helens. In 1980, it blew up with the force of 1,600 times the Hiroshima atomic bomb. It was actually witnessed. There's actually a video on YouTube. You can watch Mount St. Helens explosion. It was awesome. 250 mile an hour winds, and it blew trees flat 10 miles away. That's about 15 kilometers away, flat. It was just an explosion. Literally blew the top off. So all this water, mud, lava came down in what they call pyroclastic flows. And if you look at the top, it's all gone. And in the distance, you see that lake that's called Spirit Lake. And before that, there's about 600 feet of debris from the mountain that was pushed down on there. And of course, it all turned into rock. 2 years later, 1982, there was another eruption. And this caused more pyroclastic flows to come down the mountain and to go through the material that was laid down 2 years earlier and carved this canyon. You see that canyon? That was carved in 1982. How do we know? We saw it. I don't mean me, we humans. So if you were to ask, somebody says, well, how long did it take to carve that there canyon? You'd be asking the wrong question, because we know by observation that that river did not carve the canyon. It was carved by a catastrophe, the 1982 mountains that swept down and created this canyon in one fell swoop. And notice on the sides of the canyon that was formed in 1980. What do you notice? Picture could have been better quality, but you notice that all the strata. And you have, for an example, this is 20 feet. laid down in one day. So we know this true because we know when this happened, people were observing it. So if I can get 20 feet in one day, or Steamboat Arabia, 45 feet in 132 years, why do I have to believe that the Grand Canyon took the buildup material, millions or billions of years, when what we can observe is to the contrary? So what you do need in order to move a lot of to create the canyon and to bring the material in there in the first place, you need a lot of water. Where does a lot of water come from? Well, the biblical record talks about the flood of Noah. That provides a lot of water and a lot of energy in order to carve the Grand Canyon. Interestingly enough, secular geologists are coming to accept that there was a lake called Lake Missoula, which was dammed up in the continent of the United States, which actually breached through the Rocky Mountains and created the Grand Canyon. So the Grand Canyon, they agree, it wasn't by slow, gradual processes, it was by very rapid processes. Okay. Now, the problem with history is that when nobody's there to observe it, you can't prove anything. You can't prove the past. But when people have actually seen this, they can say, you prove what you can't see, we'll prove what we have seen. Which do you think provides more compelling evidence? Obviously, what you can see. And so when you ask the question, if I have the same effect in observable versus unobservable, why do I have to believe Grand Canyon is billions of years old? You don't. Right? Here we have other evidences, folded sedimentary layers. You know, a lot of times people look at this and say, oh, that's interesting. What about it? How do you bend rock? How do you bend? Here's another example. How do you bend rocks 90 degrees? Look at the truck at the bottom. How do you explain that by slow building up of layers over billions of years? You think that the water came along and then moved it up in 90 degrees? Every year, just a 90 degree layer? Of course, that would be ludicrous, right? But you'd have to believe that if you required millions of years for this to form. So what's more likely to happen is that before, during the flood of Noah, all these layers were made, and then you had tectonic movement, which bent everything up together while it was still in somewhat of a plasma state, and then it bent it up, and it stayed there and hardened and turned into rock. But to presuppose it can just bend rock 90 degrees without all the shattering and fracturing of rock is very questionable. But also, how long does it take to form a fossil? Charles Darwin said, well, it was going to take millions of years. What did he base it on? Not science. Based on assumption. And so what is a fossil? A fossil is anything that turned into a rock. Ah, coat stand. Anything that turned into rock. There are about 7 processes which turn things into rock, including permineralization. And so it could be the actual bone, which had been permeabilized, mineral replacement, so we replaced the bone material with minerals and becomes rock. Or you can have simply an impression, for example, impression of a leaf. A leaf that's a leaf fossil. The leaf is gone, but you still have the impression of it. That's still considered a fossil. So when I look at these things, I think, man, they must be millions of years old. Right? Because that's how long it takes to turn something into rock, right? Millions of years? Well, I don't think so. So my son, who studied in England, we took an opportunity to go up to a place called, in York, to a place called Knaresborough. And they have, Mother Shipton has a petrifying well. It's really not that terrifying, but it turns things into rock. And so they have this well in which water with very high calcium carbonate content drips over things. They hang in there. So they have, I haven't had a lobster here in PEI. 1972, we came here, a friend of mine, my first lobster was in Charlottetown. Oh, that garlic butter. Oh, I still taste it now. Oh, man. So I didn't have one yet. Saying, before I go, have that lobster. Mm-mm. I made the mistake of introducing my sons to lobster. Oh, Trace, and they liked it. And then every time we went to McDonald's, can we get lobster? No, they don't have lobster. So they hang things in these petrifying well, and they things like hats, even John Wayne's hat, who was a famous actor, by the way, and even these teddy bears, soft, cuddly teddy bears. In 3 months, these teddy bears, here's one of them, this is no longer a soft, cuddly teddy bear, right? How long does it take to turn things into rock? Well, 3 months in this case. And here's an example of an octopus. Now, Darwin had said anything which is an invertebrate, didn't have a bone, couldn't be turned into a fossil. And yet we have a fossil of an octopus, no bones. Well, wait a minute, how do you... It looks like a modern octopus, and they were able to reconstitute the ink, and the lady drew the picture of the octopus with the ink that was in the fossil. Looks like a modern octopus. Allegedly, it's 795 million years old. How do they know? Well, they're just hoping or guessing that it is. Right? But how long does it take to make a fossil? Well, for example, here's another one, invertebrate. These are jellyfish. Now, have you ever been to the seashore? Anybody have any seashore around here? Sure, okay. But so you see a jellyfish. The next day, what's the jellyfish look like? It's kind of mushy, isn't it? Next day, it's almost gone. So if I have a jellyfish which is sandwiched or buried, in order for the impression to remain, it must turn to rock within a very short period of time, within a matter of days, not millions of years. Here we have an example of this ichthyosaur giving birth, and the fish on the bottom in the process of eating a fish. Well, you've heard about long labor pains, right? But this isn't it, right? So obviously, this is clear evidence that the fossilization of this must have been extremely rapid because there's no evidence of decay, disarticulation of the bones. Very clear. I mean, you can find these fish fossils by the millions. They're not that... So it looks like water came along and just pancaked them and fried them there, and that's where they stayed, dried, okay, dried fish. And so you can see all the ribs and the spine, etc. It must have been fossilized in very short order. It's not just the creationists who are saying this, it's actually the secularists, okay? In fact, here was a fossilized fern. This is a plant. It's turned into a rock. So fast that you can actually see cell division. Now, fern is a plant, right? When a plant dies, it starts to decay. I know that because I used to be single and had my own fridge, and I'd left things in the back of the fridge, and when eventually went to clean it, I couldn't recognize what that organic material was. So it decays pretty quick. I think it was corn, or it might have been lettuce. I don't know. So it was not edible. But the New Scientist article said, what did it admit? Almost instantly fossilized. Wow. But I don't agree with how they say it was fossilized. Suddenly engulfed by a lava flow. By a lava flow? 2,000 degrees Celsius. Now, I remember that watching that volcano from Hawaii, the lava was getting close to the car, and before it got to the car burst into flames. What do you think is going to happen to a nice little green fern? It's going to go... Right? And be covered in it. If you have a self-cleaning oven, put a fern in it. We're going to see if it'll fossilize. Right? And I'm pretty sure it ain't. Okay. Recently, some scientists have done experiments to see if they can fossilize in a lab. And they took some lizards and they put it in a process. I don't know the exact process, but within 24 hours, they were able to get fossils. And under electron microscope, you could not tell the difference. You will notice that they put fossils in quotes because they don't want you to think it's a real fossil, but it is a real fossil, okay? Because it has turned into rock. So knowing what we do about fossilization, I don't have to believe that takes millions of years to create fossil because we can actually observe it. We have the concrete evidence right here that it was actually the case. You know, there was a pun in there, okay, concrete evidence. Tough crowd, wow, okay. You know, that other church, they were much more, light on, okay. Okay. So there's something that's also, how long ago did dinosaurs died out, have we been told? Why, we told it 65 million years ago. 65 million years ago. Allegedly, it was some asteroid, create all this stuff, and they use a KT boundary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a bit of a problem with that, though, because when we look at some of the evidences, it would say that's not quite in keeping with what we know about science. In 2005, a Dr. Mary Schweitzer had been looking at a unfossilized Tyrannosaurus rex femur, a leg bone. Okay, it wasn't rock. because then you can't really do anything with it. So she was pulling out material, and this is what she found. She found these organic material, collagen, red blood cells, etc., from Tyrannosaurus rex bones. And she said it was flexible, resilient, and when stretched, returned to its original shape. Actually, CBS did a 60-minute special with her on it. I don't know if anybody saw that. What was that? Walters? What was the woman's reporter name? Barbara Walters. Maybe it was her. Okay. Anyway, so she said this. I mean, it looks like the modern, well, what she said was, when you think about it, the laws of chemistry and biology, everything else that we know, say it should be gone. It should be degraded completely. We agree. And they are virtually indistinguishable from modern tissue samples in Tyrannosaurus rex unfossilized bones. How does this work? Well, in 2005, when she did it, she says, I couldn't believe it. I did the same experiment 17 times. It came out the same thing. I couldn't believe it. When she presented it to the scientific community, they all laughed at her. Oh, Dr. Schweitzer, we know that organic material cannot last 65 million years. I mean, by all that we know about science, there's no possible way. When things die, they start to decay right away. So it's not possible. You obviously have some contamination in your lab, which is possible. Something else contaminated your samples, and we can't accept a result because what we know about science, it doesn't work like that. So she spent 10 years redoing her test in the lab. She did experiments to falsify her findings, which is what you really should do if you're doing proper science. 10 years, and finally she says, I've done it over and over and over again. I still get the same results. So then she presented it to the scientific community, and they reluctantly admitted, yes, this is organic material, unfossilized from T-Rex, and guess what? It can last 65 million years. Why? Because the obvious conclusion is that these are not 65 million years old. They were within thousands of years at best. But they can't say that because their entire house of cards rests upon a pillar that dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago. If they didn't die out 65 million years ago within a short period of time, then the whole evolutionary precipice is going to keter into the blink. So the facade has to be maintained. Now here's an example that I usually use in another talk, and it's very simple. A lot of people don't care about DNA and organic material and fossilization and all that stuff, but they might get this. In the world today, we have about 7 billion people. A lot of people. So we know that population's going up because people keep having people. And so this is what we know. The question is, in the history of it, how long does it take to get to 7 billion people? If I'm an evolutionist, if I believe this alleged last common ancestor to man evolution over millions of years, I'm going to say, well, let's just take a round number of million years, that it take a million years to build up a population large enough, you know, with all its ups and downs and extinction and things like that, take a million years to get 7 billion people. But I'm not a evolutionist. I happen to believe the biblical account is correct. And I say, well, I don't have millions of years. In fact, I don't really have 6,000 years because we're all descended from all those who came out of Noah's Ark, which were just three couples who were having kids. Noah and his wife, at 500 years, we're probably not going to have any more kids, right? So there are three couples who are having kids. So we're all descended from Shem, Ham, and Japheth 4,500 years ago. So the evolutionist says, no, it's going to take a million years or more. Creationist is going to say, 4,500 years to get 7 billion? Seems like, which do you think makes more plausible? And you're the jury. You know, this argument's 4,500. This is that for a million years. Which do you think is more plausible? How many are for the million years or more? It's okay, you can raise your hand. I'm not testing anybody here. Oh, come on. No. How many for the 4,500 years? Okay, I'm not sure you're just giving me the answer I want to hear, you know, but how many I don't really know or don't know where to do with it? All right, well, that's a good question. That's a good answer. I don't know what to do with it. Many people don't know what to do with a lot of the stuff, and that's why they bring in the so-called experts. And So what do you do with it? Well, what do we know about population growth, about world population? So I went to the source of all knowledge. I went to the internet. And on the internet, I looked for population growth. And I found a website, a page from the BBC, not the Better Bible Company, but the British Broadcasting Corporation. And they had the chart that looked like this. And I thought, well, that is very interesting. You see, because on the right-hand side, the population, as you see, is, this is what I'm doing. 7 billion. The column on the right is billions. 2000 CE is Common Era, or AD. I put the cross on there. It wasn't on their site to show you 2,000 years ago when Jesus lived on earth. And then I looked at it and I thought, well, that's interesting. About 4,500 years ago, there was a dip. Not quite dipped enough, but it really doesn't matter, right? What happened 4,500 years ago? Flood of Noah. But what I found even more interesting was that 6,000 years ago, according to BBC, there were no people except two, or very, very few. I said, this fits in almost perfectly with the biblical account. Now, some people say, well, come on, that looks too... Maybe they had a creationist on staff, and he stuck that in there, right? But that's an official website. Actually, it's for kids in British... So creation account. But let's work this a little bit more because this doesn't really say enough here. So we do know that if you look on the right, that population growth was exponential within the last century. China had in the 1940s 480 million. Now they're 1.6 billion, 2.5 times. Right? So it's gone way up and it will keep on going way up. Now some countries are going down, but you know, if it kept on going, we'd have a lot of people. How many people would we have in 1,000 years from now on Earth? Or, let's play this a little differently, if creation event was not 6,000 years ago, but was 7,000 years ago, just 1,000 years earlier, so that increase would not be at a 2,000 CE, it would be at 1,000 CE, how many people would we have on the earth today for just 1,000 years earlier? Roughly 450 billion people. Astronomical numbers. Not possible to have it on that. But that begs the question, if the evolutionist is correct, if human beings have been around here for a million more years or more, why do we only have 7 billion? How would they explain it? Well, one thing they'd say is that, well, you had these extinction events. Population rose and extinct, rose and extinct, rose, extinct, over and over again. So you would have had the remains of quadrillions and some exponent number of people, you'd need the evidence for that. You'd see the remains. And where are the remains of quadrillions of people? There isn't any. So how else did they explain it? Well, then humans were at extinction level for a million years, and only within the last 6,000 did they start having children and populating the planet. Well, we do know that, from what we know about animals, that you can't survive at extinction levels for very long before going extinct. Right? So I'm suggesting that the biblical account is actually one that's much more compelling. Can we prove it? No. But I'm suggesting that, from what we know about science, the creationist explanation is much more sustainable than millions of years, for which the evidence is greatly lacking. Okay, we got a few more things. If I can take your time, there's a few more things. Anybody need to go? Well, no. Anybody falling asleep? Good. So you may have heard about carbon dating. One T-shirt said, "If it wasn't for carbon dating, I wouldn't date at all." Okay, poor guy. And that's sad. That's really sad, you know. So many people have used this argument. Well, you know, they've been carbon dating these things. And first of all, if it's supposed to be dinosaur bone, this is a trilobite, okay, before the dinosaurs, if they use carbon-14, they don't know what they're talking about. Carbon-14 can have date nothing beyond 100,000 years. So if this thing is supposed to be hundreds of millions of years, obviously they don't. People just usually throw this out, hoping that you won't know what it is either and just be intimidated. Carbon dating? Oh man, you got me. I don't know what to do with that. Right? But actually, we love carbon dating. Why? So carbon dating is part of a radiometric dating method, and it can be complicated. I have a talk on it. We can do a Q&A session on it. But to make it very simple, that we do have some, in the case of carbon, radioactive variants or isotopes of carbon. The normal carbon breeze is carbon 12. There's a carbon 14, which is radioactive. And it decays over a fixed period of time through a half-life into nitrogen 14, which is a gas, so we don't have to worry about that. Carbon 14 is very minuscule amounts. Don't worry about it. But the decay process is unstoppable. Nothing can stop it. Once it starts decaying, it goes down to nothing. So the carbon, the half-life kind of works like this. So if this is 100% full of carbon 14, actually it's H2O. This is really good. If this is 100% carbon 14, over a half-life, 5,730 years, I'm going to have half of it, but only a half left, right? So another half-life, I'm going to have half of this. So now I'm down to a quarter. Another half-life, I'm going to have a quarter of that, which is now an eighth. And it gets smaller all the time. According to this graph, for people who like graphs, this is kind of how it works. You get diminishing amount. But basically what it's saying is that after 60,000 years, approximately, now some machines can date a little longer, maybe 90,000 years, but there should be, even if I had 100% carbon 14, over 60,000 years, I should have absolutely zero. And there's nothing that could alter that. Okay? So that's how carbon 14 works. Actually, all the radiometric dating methods work kind of like that, on radioactive decay rates. Now, the reason why carbon-14 is very good, because the other ones are half-lives in the billions of years, and very hard to calibrate, and for example, they actually have a problem with taking lava of known age, sending it to the labs for dating, and it comes back several million years old, and yet we know it's 50 years old, so there's a problem with calibration of that. But, so if I have something with anything with carbon-14, I know that it cannot be more than 60,000 years old. Doesn't mean it is. It just means it cannot be older than that. So, anybody like diamonds? Okay, assume you like diamonds, fine. All right, so diamonds are the hardest known material to mankind, right? And that's from which all the hardness tests are based around. And so they have found carbon diamonds deep in the earth of South Africa. De Beers Company mines them, and they say because it's so far down in the earth, it must be part of the basement rock or the basic structure of the earth, several billions of years old. So if you find diamonds, they say, billions of years old. And everybody says, ooh, wow, I got a billion-year-old ring or diamond. Well, what they've done is Institute of Creation Research has taken some of those diamonds, small pieces, and they send it off to the radiometric dating labs and looking for carbon-14. Now, nobody would intentionally look for carbon-14 because these are supposed to be billions of years old. Why would you look for something you didn't suspect there? But they said to go test it anyway. They all came back with carbon-14, which means that they're not billions of years old. It's like within thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. Doesn't mean it's that old. It just means it can't be any older than that. So, of course, that just shoots to pieces all this billions of old ideas. Where did they get the billion years in the first place? It was made up, right? It's based on assumptions about uniformitarian processes, which, as we're seeing, is not based on any observed science. It's based on speculation. And, for example, like I speak out west in Alberta, of course, they have oil there. You ask, how long does it take to form oil underground? Oh, millions of years. I think not. Because you can actually form oil from organic material in an hour. There's a gentleman in the United States who's actually farming algae with the intent to make it into crude oil. Same crude oil that's used to make your car run. Okay. Anybody been spelunking? Spelunking, that's cave exploring, okay, in case you didn't know. Right? And in the caves, they have these stalactites and stalagmites, you know, these pointed things in the top and bottom. If you ever do these cave exploring, they're going to say, sir, don't touch that because it took hundreds of thousands of years to form and you won't be around to see it reform. I say, I don't think so. Right? Why? We have them in Montreal. What? We have them. We don't have caves, but we do have these stalactites, stalagmites. Well, yeah. Where do you have them? We have them in our sewers. You're kidding me, right? No, we have them in our sewers. In fact, the Montreal Tourism website actually invites you to come and tour our sewers. Right? Above ground is a bit of a mess, but underground, it's wonderful. Okay? And you can see here, that is a stalactite and stalagmite joined together. Now, if you were to see it in a cave, somebody could say, well, this is 100 to 250,000 years to form. And you'd go, oh, right? You look in the sewers of Montreal, you say, 200 years old. Not that exciting. But we know that this is, the sewer was only made 200 years ago. It's not a working sewer, by the way. So, do you know that many of the main water conduits underground in Montreal are made from tree trunks? Or 100 years ago, they made them out of tree trunks. But now the tree trunks are rotting, and now they have to replace it. And it's going to cost billions of taxes. All right, a couple more things, and we're going to move it up. So I've been in aviation for 40 years. I once was a pilot, a private pilot, so I loved flying, but I actually did more work on the planes. This is a P-38 Lightning. Anybody familiar with P-38 Lightning? Anybody like airplanes as well? Oh, God bless you. God bless you. Right. So in the World War II, they were ferrying airplanes from North America over Canada, over to Greenland, over to Europe. And this happened to be P-38 Lightning and a B-17 bomber, which crash-landed, well, actually just landed on the Greenland glacier. Everybody survived, couldn't get out. They couldn't get the planes off again. So they were left there. A number of years ago, somebody, an American, said, hey, I think there was some planes up there. Maybe we can recover those planes and restore them and, you know, fly them again, which they actually did. So they said, well, okay, let's go up to Greenland. How deep are those planes? Well, they went on the internet and they looked up how fast does ice accumulate on Greenland. Now, this has a direct relation to the whole climate change argument. Why? Because the whole idea, the history of climate change, they say it comes from ice cores. Where did they get the ice cores? Out of Greenland and Antarctica. And they say, we drill these cores down there, and we pull it up, we see all these layers, and we can say how many years, et cetera, et cetera. And they say, well, what this says, this is from a secular site, physics.org, right? It's 100,000 years to form 2 to 3 kilometers worth of ice. So halfway through, it would be about 50,000 years, okay? So that's how they base it on. And they say, this is the weather, and this, or if it's darker, it's a different temperature, et cetera, et cetera. So all the temperature variation is based on these ice cores. Assuming that they are 100,000 years old, the total, all right? So he looked at that. I'm just assuming he looked at it. But anyway, the calculation was roughly 6 centimeters per year. Well, it was 50 years later. He's digging it up, roughly. So that's like 3 meters. No, it's about 9-10 feet deep. Oh, that's nothing. I'm going to get my shovel. So this guy went out there in Greenland, and then he started digging, right? And so figured about 10 feet deep, 3 meters deep, not a big problem. He kept digging, and he kept digging again, and he kept digging again. Instead of 10 feet deep, it just happened to be just a little over at 278 feet. It was a real problem because their shovels weren't that long. Okay. So they actually did go down there. It's actually covered in National Geographic. Had an article on there. They went inside, and they disassembled the plane and brought it up. But what was wrong here? The assumptions about the past were wrong. So instead of 6 centimeters per year, based on the time and the depth, it worked out to be an average of 1.7 meters per year, about 28 times faster than what was estimated. I mean, this is based on observed, we see the plane, we know where it is, measured data, not an assumption. And so when you look at this 2 to 3,000 meters, at 1.7 meters per year on average, instead of taking 100,000 years to form this Greenland ice sheet, it could have all been made within 2,000 years. Translate that to climate change, that all our assumptions about these distant past are now compressed into less than 2,000 years. What does that do to all the calculations of climate change? And of course, had a big march in Montreal, et cetera, around the world, based on assumptions which have not been validated. In fact, when you look at it from this point of view, you're saying that all the assumptions about this age are wrong, right? 27 times or 28 times longer. Okay, one more thing, and this is used to help you deal with when you come across these type of things. So I was on researching on the internet, and I came across this page, Naturalis Historia. The Nika Cave of Crystals is a giant problem for a young Earth. Right? Initial estimates of the age of the crystals range from hundreds of thousands to possible millions of years. Young Earth proponents, i.e. me, cannot accept the long history of these crystals, but rather believe they must have been formed within the past 4,300 years. Hence, they must believe the cavern itself is a recent origin and the crystals inside that cavern even more recently formed. If you go to BBC, they will tell you about 26 million years ago, very slowly, over hundreds of thousands of years, these crystals formed. Now, what are these crystals? I'm not exactly sure, but they're somewhere in Central America. Mining company was mining. And as they were digging down, they had to remove water because it accumulates down. And as they removed the water, they came across these crystals, gypsum crystals. Huge. Look at the guy here. You see the guys over there? Reminds me of the movie Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. These are huge crystals, 65 feet long. And the temperature, though, is 58 degrees Celsius, a little on the warm side. Okay. And here's a guy, humongous. So what... Why was this a problem for young Earth people? Well, it's because they say it takes so long for crystals to form. Hundreds of thousands of years, maybe millions of years for crystals that big to form. Is that true? How did this guy know? Did he see it happen? No. But so he asked the question, how fast do crystals form? That's a very good question. Well, actually, they have crystal growing contest. And by following this easy-to-follow procedure on YouTube, you can simply create your own crystals. And here we have this thing, let sit overnight, and in the morning, you have this crystal thing. Look at the different colors. You can turn it over, and then you can clear coat spray it to make it nice and shiny, and then you can make it into a, you know, an ashtray or maybe a candle holder, and voila. So the University of California, Los Angeles, the science department also wanted a crystal. They maybe watched this thing. They wanted like a real serious crystal. So they actually created one. 2 months they made this crystal. Roughly 1 foot per month. So what we know about science, we actually can do it ourselves. We can make crystals. And crystals 65 feet at a foot per year would have taken 65 months. That's like financing on a car. You could have either a car or 65-foot gypsum crystal, right? You're right. So that assumption, the bald assumption saying, that's a problem for you guys because it took 65 or what millions of years to form, we're saying, we don't think so because crystals, you can get the same in 5 years. So I put that to you. You know, the scientific, now there's lots more of these. We don't have time for them. We have maybe time for some questions. But and there's a fellowship time after downstairs. But when you go through and you start looking at the assumptions that people make about how old things are, you realize that they are based on not on real science, but on simply assumptions about the past. And so, you know, when you look at the biblical account, you're saying that where do all the bad things come? You know, first God had made everything according to the scripture, according to God who knows everything. He said, I made everything perfect. You people messed it up. And it became so bad that God had to destroy the world in a global flood. And it actually covered the earth and wiped out everyone except those who were in the ark. And that ark is kind of representative of Christ. You know, there was a lot of people who laughed at Noah to scorn. You're an idiot. Why are you doing this? There's never been a flood. What's this boat for? You never get all the animals on it. Only, how are you going to get all those millions of animals on the ark? But Noah kept building the ark because God, he was a righteous man. And he obeyed, he believed God. God said there's going to be a flood. You could argue with God, but he just simply obeyed God. And then the flood came and washed all the people away. I'm sure there was a lot of people when the floods, water started coming and the tsunami started happening. A lot of people were saying, Noah, Noah, let us in. We believe you now. But Noah couldn't let them in because God had shut the door. It was too late. And Jesus said the same thing's going to happen. He says, when the Son of Man comes, it's going to be like it was in the days of Noah. People were marrying and being given in marriage and eating and drinking until the day the flood came and washed them all away. And so the biblical, the gospel message is really, you need to be in Christ because he is the only ark that's going to save you from the coming judgment, from death. You know, Christianity is actually the only religion that promises to bring you to God. Islam does not promise to bring you to God. It's not in Islam. Islam brings you to a place of sensual pleasures. Every man gets to have two whores. What they call whores. They get to have two, and they have drink wine, non-alcoholic, and they have all this food, all the sensual pleasures denied on earth, you get to have in heaven. But God is not there. It's only in Christianity where you go to be with God. In my Father's house, Jesus said, are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go there, I'm going to come back and take you to be where I am. And that's what the hope of the Christian is, that death is not the end. That is, Christ has promised. And how can we take his promises? Well, he went to a cross. And even the disciples didn't believe he was going to be raised from the dead. And yet he rose from the dead. And that's why Christianity has been propelling all down to this, that God himself has taken upon himself, God has taken upon himself to pay the penalty for our sin. We are the ones who are responsible for the mess that everything is in, wars and death, etc. It's our problem. And yet God has said, I'm going to pay for it. And to reject that payment is to reject eternal life. I pray that you will not do that. May God bless you all. Anybody know what kind of plane this is? Do you know? It's a B-29, that's right. At Oshkosh in Wisconsin, yes. Brother.
Just sort of wondering maybe if you want to take a couple of questions, and then what we might do then is just, you'll be downstairs and you can move.
Sure. I'd be happy to answer any questions that I have answers for. I don't have all the answers. I know that. I don't have all the answers. But if there are any questions, that burning questions, I will tell you there's one question. This is just some, sorry, let me put this up here. Twice now on this this tour, one question came up twice. And I told a person, like, wait till the end. And you know what that question was? Where did Cain get his wife? One lady today said to me, you know, it's just been bugging me for years. Where did Cain get his wife? It's really just burning question. Why is that important? It has a context to it. Anybody know what the context of that question, where did Cain get his wife? There's a historical event in which that question came up. Anybody? Correct. Right. In 1929 in Tennessee, it was forbidden by law to teach the theory of evolution. The American Civil Liberties Union says, wow, we got to change that. So they got a guy by the name of John Scope. They told him, say that you taught evolution. You don't actually have to teach anything. Just say that you did. Okay? So then it went to trial. He said that he did. Oh, that's an offense, and you're going to go to trial. So William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow, two very famous lawyers, one was working toward being president, became the trial of the century in 1929, called the Scope Trial. And they asked a question. Now, it was later made into a movie. Anybody know the name of that movie? Black and white. Inherit the Wind was the movie based on that trial. It was corrupted, but anyway. The idea was, and so one of the questions that had persisted all along, and they asked, the lawyer asked this fundamentalist, obviously a hick Christian, you believe the Bible? Yes, okay. So then where did Cain get his wife? The idea being that you had Adam and Eve, and you had Cain and Abel, and Cain killed Abel. So then who did Cain marry to have children by, or which we are descendant? Oh, that was a stumper for the guy. I don't know. You know. And it made him look like a fool. And that film was a propaganda, that Inherited Wind, propaganda film, showed in many schools, etc., to see, look at those Christians, how stupid they are. I mean, they don't even have an answer to that simple question, where did Cain get his wife? And so it's been a legacy question. And the answer to the question is, where could Cain have gotten his wife? From mom and dad. Not his mother, but his sister. Ooh, sister? Yes, his sister. Let me ask you a question. Whom did Abraham marry? Who was Sarah to him? It was half-sister. Marrying relatives was not a problem until the time of Moses. Moses then, the law was instituted, you don't marry cousins and close relatives. Why do you think that was? Well, it has to do, what not specifically stated, but we know this is a real issue, is genetic mutation. Adam and Eve would have had perfect genes. There would have been no mutations. Okay, so their offspring would have had no mutations either. And then, of course, after the fall, they started accumulating. So Cain could have easily married his sister, no genetic mutations, anything. However, we're all descended from a bottleneck because we're all descended from one family, Noah's family. So that then becomes inbreeding in the family of Noah. So therefore, the lifespan of Adam and Eve were over 900 years, but the lifespan after Noah was dropped down from 120 years down to 70, 80, what we have now, which is could be linked to genetic mutation or genetic burden or genetic load. And this is actually a known problem of, instead of beneficial mutations, harmful mutations accumulating in the human genome over time. And this is actually called Haldane's Dilemma from J.B. Haldane. Why is it if humans are being here for a long, long time, millions of years, are we still alive? The genetic burden should have become so great that it's no longer viable. And this is a known problem in the genetic community. When you do genetic inbreeding becomes, and that could explain a lot of why the fossils that were found, such as the Hobbit, etc., had a lot of genetic mutation because of inbreeding. They all lived on the same island, and then they would have been able to breed with themselves. They didn't know anything about genetics, right? And of course, then genetic burden and led to catastrophe and the die-off, etc. That was that on that question that nobody even asked. Okay, good. Okay, we're done here. Amen.
God, Father, we thank you again for this time of instruction and learning. We thank you for Gus and for Creation Ministries and their ministry of going that we